This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. So you might think of taxidermy as a sedentary profession. Subjects are, after all, dead. And if you look at one mounted deer head compared to another mounted deer head, you might think, and I don't want to be deerist here, but they do tend to look alike. Turns out, however, there is fierce competition in the world of taxidermy, and judges can indeed tell one work from another. In fact, there's even a World Taxidermy Championship. Judges armed with flashlights and magnifying glasses examine anatomy and artistry. Nicole Trish's new documentary is called Taxidermists. It premieres at the annual Full Frame Documentary Festival this Friday at 4:30. And Nicole is also an assistant professor at the School of Communication in Elon University and with us now on the State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how did you get interested in taxidermy?
So I actually heard a story on NPR about Paul Reimer, who was a taxidermist at the Smithsonian Institute. And he was going to retire, and they decided we're not going to fill this position. So that made me think, is this a profession that is dying out? So I just want to investigate that more. So did some Googling and found the World Taxidermy Championships. And so that was my actual first shoot, was I went to the World Taxidermy Championships to kind of see what it was like. And I found that it was quite alive and well, at least in the form of commercial taxidermy.
And commercial for whom? I mean, so, and it is, maybe we should talk more about this, because in museums, it does seem that that universe of taxidermy is going the way of the dodo, the stuffed dodo, perhaps.
It definitely is. And in the film, Wendy Christensen, she is the taxidermist at the Milwaukee Public Museum. And she's actually one of the last kind of full-time taxidermist in the country that works full-time for a museum. A lot of mounts happened in museums in the 1920s. That was when it first became popular in natural history museums to have these mounts so that people could go and see these animals. These animals weren't able to survive at zoos. People weren't able to travel, so they could go to these natural history museums and see these exotic animals, and these animals stayed still for them, so they could really, you know, examine them. But a lot of museums have these mounts, and they're letting their taxidermists go because they already have the mounts, or they're actually getting rid of a lot of their mounts,
right,
and going towards technology.
Right.
And showing videos and things like that rather than having the mounts themselves.
So then when we think of commercial taxidermy, then the other area we think of is hunters who get mm-hmm. their heads mounted on the wall. And that's a rather static pose, I would think.
Yes. And so that's what most commercial taxidermists do. They mostly work for hunters. There are some commercial taxidermists who do more art pieces where they don't work for a client. They create their own and then they try to sell those pieces as well. But most of taxidermy is commercial taxidermy, and most of commercial taxidermy is deer heads and deer mounts, because that's predominantly what hunters are going after, white-tailed deer especially. But these white-tailed deer, these taxidermists can do a lot more. So I saw at the World Taxidermy Championships a lot of inventive things with white-tailed deer, including an apple, a deer eating an apple, a deer eating leaves off of trees. So they can do other things rather than just a static deer head. But yes, a lot of the deer heads look alike to me as well.
But you wouldn't have a championship if they all did. And clearly, people are competitive and mm-hmm. they're interested in it. I mean, you talked to Wendy Christensen, and she talked about winning at the championship. Let's listen.
Last year, I competed with an artificial gorilla, a gorilla recreation, and he was a very famous gorilla that died at the Milwaukee Zoo, and his name was Samson.
I thought, okay, I probably have a pretty good shot at best in the world recreation. That's probably as far as I was hoping I could do. When we're sitting at the awards banquet and I won basically competitor's choice or people's choice, and that was like, oh my God, this is just the icing on the cake. And then I won best in the world. It was like, oh, wow.
Here's Wendy Christensen, who is featured in Nicole Trish's film Taxidermist, that is going to screen at Full Frame Friday at 4:30. We're talking to Nicole now. Tell us more about Wendy and how you found her.
So Wendy was at the World Taxidermy Championships when I went in 2011. She actually won in 2009. So when I was there and went in 2011, I was definitely looking for a variety of taxidermists. And so I was looking for female taxidermists, which there were a surprising amount of at the Worlds, surprising to me at least. And a lot of people recommended, you got to talk to Wendy. Wendy is very well thought of in the industry. And so I just went up to her and said, hey, you mind sitting down for an interview? She sat down for an interview then. And then I actually went to the Milwaukee Public Museum where she works and spent a few days with her later on and found, you know, got more footage of her and interviewed her more.
So does she bring her art to – because when I think of going to natural – the old-style natural history museums, they are pretty static-looking creatures. I mean, does she kind of bring the art forward and try to show them in motion more? I mean, is that part of what she does at the museum?
So for the museums, what they definitely want to do at museums is to have exact anatomy. That's their main thing. Their science. That's what they're looking for rather than – art. She obviously tries to bring in artisticness into hers, but it has to be anatomy first and foremost. And so what they do are dioramas at her museum. And those are oftentimes scenes with multiple animals, sometimes different breeds of animals in the same scene. And she tries to create a story within that diorama. And so that's what she really concentrates on. And so storytelling plus anatomy.
You know, next you could do a film on the people who make the trees for the dioramas, but I suppose that's getting ahead of the story. Dennis Harris is another guy you talk to, and he had a sculpture, I guess you can call it, taxidermy sculpture called Air Moose, which I would like you to describe for us.
So what Air Moose is, so imagine there's a base, and on that base are some rocks and some fake snow and there's some greenery. And then from that base, there is a moose, and the moose is running. And the only part of the moose that's on the ground is just one hoof. So his back legs are sprawled out behind him. And he's actually being attacked by 8 wolves. And so some of those wolves seem to be kind of flying beside of him as if they've leaped up at the moose. And there's another wolf on the ground that's snarling up at him. And then there's a wolf actually climbing up the back of the base. And so the only piece that's actually on the ground is this one moose hoof. Everything else is suspended off of the moose.
And it's suspended mostly by gravity. There's not a lot of poles and stakes here keeping things in place, right?
Yeah, there's nothing hanging from the ceiling. There's an interior skeleton that Dennis has commissioned from a welder. And so that's – and all the moose and all the wolves are off of that skeleton.
Wow. So it's a giant mobile.
Yes.
It's incredible. And Dennis is very, very serious about his art.
I would like to get rid of the word taxidermy because it will never, ever, ever leave the stereotype. Wildlife artist is what we are. It has gone from dead animals hanging on the wall that look dead to full-blown art sculptures that can compete with the greatest flat artists and the greatest sculptors in the world.
Now, that said, Dennis didn't win with that amazing composition of his.
He did not.
What did and why, do you think?
A Gobi Argali sheep is what won.
Just one little sheep?
Well, it's a pretty big sheep. It was actually there was a plaque on the base that said this was the second largest that had ever been taken. And so that helped. And also Dennis described it in the film that he's saying that he was judged on 9 animals rather than on 1 animal. Mm. And so you can find a lot more flaws in 9 animals rather than 1. I haven't seen the score sheets. Apparently the scores are very close to one another. But that's how Dennis describes his loss.
And what are the judges looking for?
So they're definitely looking for anatomy, but they're also looking for design. So the entire piece, they're looking for negative space and positive space. So they're looking for the entire piece having design elements that we would see in a painting or in a drawing. They're looking for movement. They're definitely looking for kind of a recreation of life. They're looking for that spark so that if you were to just pass this mount in the hallway that you maybe could think that could possibly be alive.
Here's the interesting thing. We talked about the fact that museums aren't using taxidermists anymore. So you would think it's a dying field, and yet it's not. It's huge. A lot of taxidermists.
Yes, there's thousands of taxidermists in the country. And there's a big presence in North Carolina of taxidermists. And the taxidermists, Dennis is in Michigan, Wendy's in Wisconsin. They both have large taxidermy constituents there as well. So it is definitely alive and thriving in the commercial world.
So your film screens at Full Frame Friday at 4:30. It's called Taxidermist. Full Frame's come a long way. It's now an Academy Award qualified festival. Tell us what that means.
So it's for the shorts. So if whoever wins this year, the short documentary winner that's been judged by the jury, then they are put into the pool for the Academy Awards. You have to get into that pool first. Then you can submit your film to the Academy. And then that those films that are submitted, they get weeded down to 8 for a short list. And then a group of people decide, okay, who are the 3 to 5 that actually get nominated for the Academy Award. But you cannot submit your film unless you have either played in L.A. or New York for at a theatrical distribution for a week, or you win in a film festival. And there's only 25 film festivals that you can are qualifying
are
film
qualified.
Festivals. So Full Frame is one of those festivals. So it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal. It means I crossed that threshold and it's on the way. And you were a judge for many years, not obviously this year, at Full Frame, and just in getting the films into the festival, right?
So I was on the selection committee, which is a big committee that helps to determine what films get in the festival. In the end, it's up to the Full Frame staff, but we help them weed out.
You watch a lot of films.
Yeah, I watch. It's about 150 that I watch per year.
Does that help you as a filmmaker?
See? Definitely. Yeah. I tell my students at Elon, that's the easiest way to become a better filmmaker is to watch more films.
Well, we will watch yours. 4:30 on Friday. Taxidermist is going to screen at the Carolina Theater. 4:30, part of the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. And, of course, a whole list of great films beginning Thursday, going right through the weekend. Festival starts tomorrow, goes through Sunday. And, you know, you can go to fullframe.com. What is it?
I think it's .org.
You know, you can search it. You just do one of those Googles, you find it real quick. Just ahead, we're going to talk to Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker Jessica Yu on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Imagine the challenge of making a film that centers on a man who can barely move. Jessica Yu took on that challenge and won an Academy Award for her efforts. The film is called Breathing Lessons, The Life and Work of Mark O'Brien. It features a man confined to an iron lung, and it's one of the films that will screen at this year's Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. In fact, the festival will pay tribute to Jessica Yu by screening a retrospective of her work from the past 20 years. And that is a collection that reflects a range of interests, from the water crisis to art to mental health. And she will premiere a new film at Full Frame called The Guide. Jessica Yu joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk about your new film, The Guide. It's about really the human side of sustainability, the sustainability effort in Mozambique. Tell us a little about the film and what drove you to make that film.
Sure. Yeah, as you said, the film is looking at the human side of the conservation issue through kind of a coming-of-age story of a young man who helps out at the national park that's being restored. It's a war-torn park in Mozambique called Gorongosa. It's a beautiful place, but I think when he first decided to get involved, he was thinking, you know, maybe I can be a tour guide and get some tips. And as the park is restored and as he learns more about the big picture, you can see his horizon sort of opening up. So that's the idea, is to sort of look at the big picture through his experience.
And he is Tonga.
Yes.
Tell us about him, and how did you find him?
Well, this is the funny thing. You know, when we the challenge was to make a film about the human side of the project that was happening there. And, you know, there were so many different threads of people on staff. You know, there were scientists, people working in the community and the community members, and it just seemed like a real challenge to try to find one thread. And we were introduced to this young man, Tonga, more kind of as a way like, hey, you know, this young guy is really sharp. He can be one of your PAs. He can help carry things. And then as we got to know him and his interests, I started to think, you know, he's the person who's going to represent the next generation. Mm. And what happens to him will reflect on the future of the project as a whole. And, of course, he turned out to be a really interesting young man. So that's how we proceeded with him.
But it is interesting because you start out with this concept, conservation, all of its complexities, particularly in a place like Mozambique where poverty is such an issue. And that word issue is kind of key. And then all of a sudden you find a human being and say, oh, wait a minute, let's follow this guy and kind of understand how it goes.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. When you enter a project, you try to do all your research, you try to have kind of a blueprint, but you're always trying to be open to the spontaneous, fantastic thing that comes up. And, you know, it's always the unplanned the unplanned development that turns out to be the key. In this case, I have to say we were floating out for a while before we found him, and then of course we had the biologist E.O. Wilson show up on the scene, and then we really knew we were onto something.
Right, and we should find out a little bit more about Mozambique. Really, one of the poorest countries in the world. Life expectancy there, does it reach 50?
Under 40. And so I think that all of these conservation questions and issues and the idea of trying to preserve ecosystems for the future takes on a different light when you realize that, if someone doesn't see a real aging generation around them, what does it mean to be, preserving trees?
Hmm.
I think the argument takes on a very different, human perspective in that situation.
And for a young man like Tonga, and we have a clip from the film, this possibility is a really important possibility. Let's listen to this clip.
Since when I was young, I wanted to be a tour guide, but I didn't know how to get a chance to be a tour guide. I don't know how this chance came for me to get up my dreams.
You really have to understand that the opportunity to work at the park is 1 in 10 million. It took a lot of courage for Tonga to walk up to Greg and introduce himself.
So it was my first time to see white people in that place.
It was the first time ever in your life?
Exactly.
Really?
I wanted to know, but what are these people coming to do here?
Yeah. You're going to graduate from high school.
This is the first time happening in my community.
You're the first one?
I'm the first one.
There's a clip from The Guide, which will screen at this year's Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. Jessica Yu is the director of that film. So tell us about what the process was like, the filming process for that movie.
Well, again, it was such a challenge because of the scope of the project, of what they're trying to do on the ground. Gorongosa was the battlefield during the 17-year civil war, and so the animal populations are decimated. They're trying to build up a certain amount of tourism. They have projects out in the community. So we were kind of running around and learning what was happening by filming it and talking to people. So it was a very interesting way of being able to work, and you realize that you don't really understand until you actually get over there. So that was a project where we were researching by filming, which is usually not recommended.
No, that sounds like a very expensive way to go.
Well, we knew that we were going to have a certain amount of time on the ground and that we also wouldn't have a real feeling for what was happening until we were there. And then out of that, once Tonga emerged, then we were able to focus the story and really use him as, quote, our guide for going through the project and learning about his life.
Did you find yourself having to change direction often because you were making these new discoveries as you went along?
Yeah, and that's something that I think probably early on in my career would have been a little more unnerving, but mm-hmm. because you start to get a little more confidence in the unknown and the idea that you're as prepared as you can be for that unknown that turns out to be the good part of what you're doing. So I enjoy that. But again, when you have a limited amount of days on the ground, you have a limited amount of resources, you also feel like, okay, we can't fool around.
Right.
We're making this decision to follow this young man.
Well, it's
kind of what we're doing.
It's kind of nice to have both the experience to know that you cannot know for a while.
Yeah.
And also the experience of a filmmaker to be able to get it done, fairly quickly once you put your feet on the ground and get moving.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing about filmmaking, especially documentary filmmaking, is knowing that you never have all the answers. Mm-hmm. There's never a point where you say, okay, well, I've finished that project. Now I've got all the tools to handle whatever comes up. You realize that uncertainty is part of the process and that you have to embrace it. And I think it definitely keeps you on your toes.
It's a little like raising children. What you learn from the first cannot apply to the second. It's somebody's third rule of child rearing.
This is true.
So tell me about this, because, again, the complexity here not only is sort of having to learn as you go, but as privileged people living in a country where the life expectancy is over 70, conservation's pretty easy for us. We have to save these animals. It's a much different story in Mozambique, and I want to get you to talk a little bit about that and what your film portrays.
Well, I guess one thing about having Tonga as our subject is that I didn't want to use him just as a conduit for, let's say, an outsider's perspective or my point of view. I wanted to find out what was his perspective. And his is very different in that he's trying to bridge what he's learning from outsiders, from the staff, from the scientists, this sort of big picture knowledge with his knowledge of the community and what people need, how they live, what the priorities are. So he has a unique perspective in understanding all sides and also a tremendous amount of responsibility. So one of the issues in the film is the cutting down of trees on the mountain that collects the water for the, you know, for the park and the communities around it. And, you know, it's a classic case of short-term needs having a long-term effect. And so he is in this position of understanding the need on both sides and trying to figure out how to navigate, how to convey that understanding in a way that will improve the situation. So that's the challenge that he faces. And it's something that I kind of I learned over time. Like, I remember interviewing him and him talking about the strange pressure he has in the position that he's in. I don't want to, you know, sort of give away the revelations in the film, but that was a great moment where I actually said, oh, Tonga, I understand you now. I understand what you've been trying to tell us. And it was kind of funny. It took a while for me to actually understand.
Some of the complexities and the paradoxes that he's facing, and, of course, a lot of pressure. What do you think, how do you think it affected him to be going through all this and having, you know, the opportunity to have one of the very few jobs in a preserve like this, but at the same time being the subject of a film and being asked these questions, which sort of brings him to an arch narrative, right? I mean, he's having to answer questions that ultimately that he might not have had to answer had he just applied for the job and gotten it.
Right. Well, Tonga's a very thoughtful person, and he is really kind of unfazable in a way. He has a kind of dignity to him that is unusual in a person his age. At the same time, you know, you're right. We're asking him questions about the big picture, about, you know, the deep thoughts, and he's camping carry equipment, and he's translating for us. We were a very funny little motley crew going through this. But I think he's someone who's learned to take opportunities as they come and take them in stride. And, you know, like he introduced himself to Greg Carr, the person who had started this current, you know, restoration project, and just, you know, walked up to him, had never seen, you know, white guy in his village before, and started speaking English to him. So I think, again, it was kind of serendipitous that we found someone who could open himself up to the experience in that way and open himself up to us as we went along this process together.
I want to talk to you about your other films because congratulations. The Film Festival is paying tribute to you and going back over your 20-year career. First of all, what is it like to have, you know, have a tribute all of a sudden? Does it make you feel a little grayer than you did before
this
end?
It's really flattering, and it's an honor because I've been to Full Frame a few times, and I mean, it's a great festival that's really, I think, about appreciating the genre. And actually, it's a place where I met Greg Carr, the man I was just talking about, who is helping restore Goran Gosa. I met him at Full Frame.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of nice associations with that. At the same time, I'd say that actually the most pressure I've felt is just trying to find all of the film prints and the masters of these films and realizing that I'm the world's worst self-archivist and wishing I could fire myself. But other than that, I'm actually looking forward to seeing some of these films in the proper screening situation. You know, I haven't seen some of them in such a long time. So.
Well, one of them that you made very early in your career was one I talked about in the introduction, Breathing Lessons. Tell me more about that film.
That film came about because I had written about going to a film festival with a very silly, fun little film called Sour Death Balls, which is also in the tribute. And I wrote it for this news service, and Mark O'Brien wrote for the same news service. So Sandy Close, the woman who runs the Pacific News Service, she put us together. And I remember thinking at the time, I don't know if I'm the right person to do this, but I was fascinated by Mark's writing. He's a very fantastic writer, just a real urgency to communicate. So I think I was attracted to that, and also to the challenge, as you mentioned, of trying to depict the rich inner life of someone who has such a restricted physical life.
And that is Mark O'Brien, the man you're
That's
talking about.
Mark O'Brien.
Writer.
So, yeah, since the age of six, he was in an iron lung and very, very restricted movement. But at the time I met him, he was only able to go out of the lung for about, 3 hours every 2 or 3 weeks. Hmm. So it was that challenge, I think, was interesting and a good artistic challenge for me. So, and we also just really hit it off. So the film kind of is divided into this very realistic depiction of his restricted physical life as a person with severe disability, and then trying to show the life in his poetry that is that can go anywhere. So that's the idea.
Well, and to give us all a sense of how difficult this is and how many restrictions he faced, he battled polio. By this time, even difficult to understand him, you've subtitled the film, and I just want to play this short clip from the film.
Polio is caused by a virus. Most people get it. It doesn't affect them very bad. But some people like me get it bad. I got it so bad that I can't use my limbs. And I have a hard time breathing.
When you take on it's a remarkable story, certainly, and he's a remarkable talent. But if you take on a story as a filmmaker like this, is it a fundamentally different approach to filmmaking when your subject isn't going to move much?
I think so. I mean, it's funny. One thing about this tribute is trying to look at these films and see if there's a thread in the subject matter. And I would say that I tend to like those kind of challenges because there's a freedom in the solution. You know, you have to kind of order off the menu because there's not much to work with that would be the obvious material. I mean, in the case of, not to skip to another film, but in the realms of the unreal, it's a film about a recluse and there's only three pictures of him. There's no home movies or, sound bites or anything like that. So in the case of Mark, the restrictions again were quite freeing, but yes, it became something that was kind of an operating principle. And Mark himself was very excited about the idea of being the only voice in the film. That was another decision. As you can hear from that clip, his voice is hard to understand a lot, and he had been the subject of some local news stories and things like that, and usually they wouldn't let him speak at all. You know, he always had something he wanted to say, but it would very quickly devolve into, so this story of the triumph of the human spirit shows that you can conquer anything, and there he'd be just kind of in the background on his wheelchair. So that's why the decision to subtitle became another thing that really freed us up to put in the content we wanted.
Well, it's interesting. We just put you in the position of Tonga, of course. Now we're asking you to answer these questions about the work that you're doing. You're saying, well, no, wait, I hadn't thought about that. But clearly you have, and you've made some fantastic decisions. That one won you an Oscar. And then in between time, I understand that you spend time directing television shows and TV commercials as well.
Yes. I have a bit of a spectrum of work, which is great. I mean, for a lot of reasons, as you can imagine, it's not the easiest thing to make a living off of documentary filmmaking, but it's also wonderful to have different sets of muscles, different toys to play with, different scale of production in different jobs. So I find it's kind of constantly reviving to be able to jump from one thing to another.
Well, is it fundamentally different to do like Grey's Anatomy, for instance? You've directed a few episodes of that program. To the approach that you would take to directing a scripted program with professional actors versus documentary, I would think it would be a fairly different kind of exercise.
It is. The thing about it is that the scale is entirely different. You're working with a group of people who have been working on this thing for a while, so you're there as kind of an invested visitor. I always think of myself as like a foreign exchange student. You kind of jump in and try to bring something to the table. But it is fundamentally different in that way. But again, I think all of directing boils down to it boils down to communication, having a plan, and finding ways to convey what's in your head. So the idea is the same, but it's a different skill set. And I think that's one thing I really enjoy about filmmaking in general, is that it's a very demanding skill set, and it changes all the time. So you have to kind of bring your different toolboxes out. But you'll be in a project, and you'll think, oh, you know, I need something from this other toolbox. And so it's nice to find, say, a piece of direction that you're giving to an actor that you realize is something you learned during the making of a documentary. And I think that's where this nice sort of cross-pollination can happen.
Well, it's a great pleasure to talk with you, and glad you're going to be here for the festival. Jessica Yu, what a pleasure. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it as well. Thanks.
Jessica Yu, a filmmaker based in Los Angeles, Full Frame is paying tribute to her larger body of work during the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. The Guide and Breathing Lessons will screen together on Saturday, April 6th at 7:40 at the Carolina Theater in Durham. There will be other films by Jessica Yu as well. And for more information, go to fullframefest.org. Just ahead, author Natalie Diaz talks about her new book, My Brother Was an Aztec. Stay tuned.